Tom Woods Show, episode 1450.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook, called AOC is Wrong, The Upside-Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Hunt Tooley is back with us again. We just had him on last week to talk about the Treaty of Versailles, which had rather something significant to do with how the 20th century unfolded. So that one is not one to skip over, particularly my history people. You got to know that stuff. But I'm having him back because I want to talk about an episode we have not yet covered on this show, and that is the 1953 coup in Iran led by British and U.S. intelligence against Mohammad Mossadegh. I mean, we're going to talk about the details of it, the Iranian prime minister. And this had consequences for later. This is the classic example of what Ron Paul referred to as blowback, a term he did not invent but certainly helped to popularize. And I saw that Hunt had given a talk on this, so I thought he's the perfect person to have back because of his wide knowledge of these events. So I want to remind you, he is the chairman of the Department of History at Austin College in Texas, and he's the author of the book to read on World War I, namely The Great War, Western Front and Home Front. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1450. Hunt, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
Hard to believe that in 1450 episodes, I hadn't yet devoted one to Operation Ajax. It's crazy, and yet given that it has, it's not just ancient history, as it was famously said, it really is of continuing relevance to the world we live in. So I found out that you had given a talk on this, and I thought, this is just absolutely perfect. Let's bring Hunt on. Let's talk about this episode. So we're talking about a coup that took place in which the CIA was involved, along with the British, in Iran in 1953.
Yep.
Now, and there is a... Well, let's set the stage here. What's going on in 1951 that's going to culminate in Operation Ajax in 1953? What development in Iran is going on?
Tom, that is the $64 question, and it's a piece of this coup. I mean, a lot of people are learning about Operation Ajax and the coup attempt, or the coup that actually succeeded. But there's interesting things, as you point out, that happened before this. In essence, the British, since 1913, had controlled all, had been sort of handed over by a corrupt, the old Qajar Shah regime. So these kings, these corrupt kings, had been sort of handed an oil contract in which they controlled all of the oil resources in the, at least in the southern part of Iran, where most of the oil was, and controlled Abadan, this this big refinery complex on an island at the head of the Persian Gulf. And also, from all the proceeds of the oil, the British managed to give the Iranians, the Persians at that time, something like 8 or 10% once the British had sort of finished the account. So anyway, they owned all that oil. The contract had been rewritten in 1919 to give slightly better circumstance to a new Shah who came in, the Pahlavi regime, and that was this man was the father of the person we know as the Shah. That was right after World War II. And in the process, they tried to renegotiate in the 30s, and there was tension between the British and the Iranians. I mean, the Iranians, one thing about our man who was overthrown that we're talking about, when I say our man, our object of study, is Mohammad Mossadegh, who was the prime minister who would be overthrown in 1953 by the United States. But one thing that he commented at some point when an American representative said to him, well, why don't you just let the British come in and negotiate and create this new deal? Mossadegh said, you don't know. Everything that they have come here to Persia and done, they have just lied to us in every single case. So the tension in that emerging, that world emerging from the British Empire and British colonial control, was that the old hardcore opponents of empire and the old patriots of these countries that the British had ruled over just couldn't stand the British. So in any case, what happens during the war is that the United States and Russia and the UK invade Iran to prop up. They overthrow they just fire the old Shah and put his son into place. And that's Mohammad Reza Shah, the one that we know from the Iranian Revolution 79. But he was very weak. And there was a longstanding movement in Iran that was what we would call a kind of classical liberal movement, a movement for a constitution. There was a whole constitutional revolution in 1905, 1906, 1907. That's a very interesting and important precursor to all this. But these constitutionalists, like Mohammad Mossadegh, were just waiting for their chance to limit the power of these dictatorial kings, these authoritarian kings. So there was a movement in the parliament. Iran has had a parliament since 1905. And there was a movement in the parliament to get a better deal with the British. The British refused. And so Mossadegh, as a member of parliament, the Persian Majlis, he led a movement to nationalize the British oil holdings. So that meant that Iran would take over all these areas. And in the way that Mossadegh had eventually also would enforce land reform, he was not in any sense a socialist as he nationalized this. His plans were to get this back into the control of the Iranians and do business that way. And in the same way with the lands, he didn't wipe out the aristocracy. He rearranged the unfair holdings and so forth. He was very much a kind of a classical liberal Republican. He wanted a better constitution. He wanted more controls on the powerful parts, the police parts of government. And so this move to nationalize it just made the British furious at a time when they were losing influence in the post-war period all over the world, in India, in many other places. And so since oil was also involved and the British had controlled this oil and run their navy and everything else on the basis of this oil, then they pulled out the stops to try to end this nationalization, which took place in the first days of Mohammad Mossadegh's tenure as prime minister. So he was in the parliament, spearheaded this movement to nationalize, then was elected prime minister and was prime minister for 2 years until he was overthrown by the Americans. So here's the thing. The British responded to this nationalization by means of a blockade, which the British are, of course, experts in. And they blockaded the head of the Persian Gulf. When some other countries tried to say, well, you know, you're really illegal, and we're Italians, and we get oil from Persia, and we just go buy from the new Persian Iranian oil company that now owns the oil. The British would intern such tankers. For example, there was an Italian tanker called the Rose Mary that the British just took it into port. And in this case, it was Aden, a British hangout, not Gibraltar, as the current, as the very parallel current case is. But they interned them in Gibraltar. And therefore, nobody else wanted to sail to Persia to bring oil out. So effectively, they stopped the oil. But also, Tom, they stopped everything else. In other words, they put a complete embargo. They froze Iranian assets in other countries. They did all of the usual, you know, menu of forcing a country to give up in a dispute. But that still didn't do it. Mossadegh was tremendously popular. So the British turned to Washington, and it was still Truman in office. And Truman really didn't want to become at least publicly a part of this picture, because there was still this residue in the Democratic Party of anti-imperialism. You know, this goes on even during World War II with the Roosevelt administration. There's still, if you read the diplomatic correspondence, there's this, all the imperialist powers of the world were on our side, but they realized they had to tread lightly if they wanted to United States support for their empires after the war. So there was still this residue, and this came out of the Truman administration. He said, I just don't want to, you know, it's a constitutional regime, it's a democracy, and it's that's what they're going for, and I just don't think it's right. So the British began to flood the country with agents, MI6 agents and their assets. They began to pay money to presses to subvention the various newspapers and news sources in Iran. And still they couldn't overthrow the government. They hoped they could. They tried to, but they couldn't overthrow it. So then the election happened in 1952. And in early 53, Eisenhower becomes president. And his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, is also, of course, the brother to the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles. And these two wage a campaign with Eisenhower, who also had his reservations at first. But these two wage a campaign, and they persuade Eisenhower in April 1953 to go through with this whole coup project. And they're going to call it within the CIA, as you mentioned, Operation Ajax. So what had happened before had helped destabilize some of the factors in Iran, political factions and so forth and so on. But it really just prepared the ground for the United States to come in and redo things and take the coup and go ahead and overthrow Mossadegh. So that's the part that you refer to that goes ahead. And it's really important that the same things that we see happening in this region today, I mean, literally the same kinds of actions are at work. It's just amazing.
Let's pause for a second and ask about how libertarians specifically ought to evaluate this, because the nationalization of the oil industry surely involves the cancellation of legitimate contracts. And I don't know how we evaluate the agreement that the British have in this situation, but in a private society, presumably there would be some form of retaliation if contracts were just abruptly and arbitrarily canceled. So now that doesn't mean that you would be able to respond in any old way and with, you know, out of proportion to the offense. But I mean, aren't there some wrongs being done here from a libertarian point of view? I mean, I'm just wondering how we should think about the whole picture.
Right. Yeah, I think the violation of contract goes back, and I certainly agree with these points. And of course, this was not a libertarian society. I mean, it was at the beginning of the century, Iran had one of the most corrupt and authoritarian of regimes, and corrupt in this sense. And I know this is a long answer to a pointed question, but it was corrupt in the sense that it wanted modern military things and needed the money, and therefore just looted national the resources of the country. That is to say, they were confiscating land and confiscating tobacco. They just, you know, at one point, the Persian shahs in the late 19th century just said, well, all tobacco that all farmers are growing, that's going to be ours. We're going to take all of that, and that will just be income for the government. So that was the situation, and it was part of these kings' deals to make a deal with the British, where the British were supposed to give Persia 16% of the proceeds of the oil, and they set up this Anglo-Persian oil company, and that's this thing I mentioned before. But here's the thing: the Persians never. These kings never got even 16%, because the British and a number of scholars have dealt with this issue, probably more like 6 or 7%. So the British, in a sense, had dealt with this with a corrupt regime, which had just had a revolution to install a constitution and a parliament and whatnot. And the kings made the deal anyway over the heads of the newly elected parliament. And, you know, it's just to tell you the truth, it was a kind of corrupt thing. So when the so after World War One, the Iranians try to renegotiate. And the British, I think contractually, the British are the first who break the contract. And in each case, they supply less. So if that's the, if we're talking about the contract, I think they had just had enough. I mean, I think the Persians just said, well, you know, you've broken it. And of course, then a nationalization, that sounds like, you know, the nationalization of heavy industry in Britain after World War II or the nationalization of railways and so forth. And as I say, I think Mossadegh was more of a classical liberal than that. I think he sometimes talked about the national goods and things like that, but he was certainly an individualist and made numerous statements about individualism in society and his attempt to, his hope to reintroduce it. He was a secular politician and in favor of a secular kind of society run by a constitution. So I think, at least, I don't know if we all, I doubt that we all of us libertarians can forgive him, but I can forgive him and forgive the Iranians for just asserting that the British couldn't swindle them any longer.
Folks, before we continue, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor, and it's a favor that's going to help you. When I first started promoting Skillshare quite a while ago, I think they had 15,000 classes. Now they've got 29,000 classes in design, illustration, business, technology, photo and film, entrepreneurship, writing, you name it. These are classes that fuel your curiosity, creativity, and career. My own daughters have used Skillshare to enhance their enjoyment of and skill with some of their own personal hobbies, but you can also use it to get a leg up in your career by acquiring a new skill that makes you stand out from the crowd and that even one day could be the basis of your own business. Now, you can join the millions of people already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of access to all 29,000 classes for free. So this is the favor I want you to do for me. Go over to Skillshare.com/woodsfree and snag those 2 free months right now. That's Skillshare.com/woodsfree for 2 free months. How could this be bad? You're going to be thanking me. Skillshare.com/woodsfree. Let me ask about the CIA's involvement. Obviously, the British are there first, but what kinds of activities are the CIA implicated in here?
Well, one of the amazing things, Tom, is that we have the book on this. We literally have an inside description of how this all happened. It was written by Kermit Roosevelt, who was the man in charge of the coup. This, I think, is quite remarkable. Because so many times we have to analyze the deep state from the standpoint of, ambiguous signals and interpretation of actions and things like this, like the old Sovietologist who would just, you know, have people watching the lights in the Kremlin to see which ministry was working late that night. But in this particular case, there was a book that Kermit Roosevelt, so having carried out the coup, being totally proud of it, wrote the book in the midst of the Iranian Revolution of 79-80. So I think this prompted him to say, yes, I set all this up and I set up the Shah and I'm going to write what I did with pride. And so we have the book. We know exactly what he did. The CIA finally, I mean, in the wake of all this, it was well known, but the CIA finally admitted that it had done it in 2013, put some documents online. There are CIA documents relating to Operation Ajax online. So we know a lot about it. And so I preface these comments. Now, I'll list things. Well, Kermit Roosevelt, who was a grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, cousin to FDR, 37 years old, had been an OSS agent in World War II, now was the head of the Middle East desk in the CIA. And Here's what he did. He prepared the ground by, doubling the amounts the British had given to the press, making sure that the whole press would put out whatever signals he wanted. And then he wrote articles for the press branding Mossadegh as an atheist and as a communist and all these different charges. In fact, in the book, he says, yeah, it was really fun. I would write an article and then send it to our Iranian assets. They would give it to the newspaper. And then the CIA analyst across the hall would come into my office and say, look at this article that's been translated into English from a Persian newspaper. They hate Mossadegh. And it would be his own article he'd written 4 days before. So he had people planting articles. He made a deal with a couple of brothers who were total monarchists. They were named Rashidi family. And they were also connected with the underworld. So from the very beginning, there was this kind of standing invitation to the various mob elements in Tehran that they would participate on order. As I've said, the CIA was involved at every level. Kermit Roosevelt arrived on July 16th. So he was actually on the ground for about a month before the coup took place in the middle of August. And meanwhile, he negotiated and gave money to the whole thing. In fact, here's an interesting part of the summer of 53. Everybody was ready. So there's this young Shah in power, and he's not quite sure which way to go. He's not his dictatorial father. He's kind of a playboy. He enjoys a good life. He's in Europe more than he's in Iran. And here in this crisis, then, he's about to accept the role of a constitutional monarch, of a real constitutional monarch. And the CIA comes to him and says, well, what about becoming, you know, throwing out Mossadegh and you taking over as, you know, as more of a powerful guy? And he says, well, I don't think I want to do it. He said, it sounds dangerous and plus a lot of work and all that. So there's a meeting in the summer of 1953 they meet in April, actually. So it's Allen Dulles, head of the CIA, Loy Henderson, the ambassador to Iran, a bunch of British agents and American agents, MI6 and CIA, and then Ashraf, the twin sister of this young Shah or king. And they bribe her, as they bribed the Rashidi brothers and all the others, and pile things, money, and they give her a fur coat, and there's all kinds of things involved. And she agrees to bolster up her brother. Although even in Tehran, Kermit Roosevelt was meeting the Shah secretly to get all this done. So when the day came for the first uprising, and the coup didn't work on August 16th, they tried. That's when they launched it, and it didn't work. Mossadegh was not overthrown. But in both coups, that one and the one that came a few days later, it was simply the case that they would essentially hire a mob to go out and break windows and beat people up and hold up signs saying, "We love Mossadegh."
Yeah.
And then they would, yeah, yeah. And so.
Not very subtle. Not very subtle.
I know. And they broke into the parliament. And I mean, so they did this. But then there's another mob hired by the same Rashidi brothers to go fight with the first one. So there's chaos in the streets. There's violence. Several hundred people got killed in these things. The survivors got paid. And then they enlisted the military. They had a general on ice they were waiting to bring out. And that man, Zahedi, is the one who eventually they're going to replace Mossadegh with. And he's, the typical strongman working for the Shah, who becomes in the process a typical strongman. They pulled out the stops, Tom. They did all kinds of skullduggery. One thing they did was to make sure that the father of Norman Schwarzkopf, that famous commander of Desert Storm, his father also had connections to the Middle East. He was also a general and had, in fact, when the Americans and British occupied Iran during the Second World War, he had organized the police because he had formerly been the commander of the New Jersey State Police, which is a very weird connection. But since he had these connections, Schwarzkopf made a trip to the Middle East and stopped off again to persuade the Shah. So they just pulled out all the stops, everybody they could think of who might. Well, Averell Harriman traveled to Iran to try to talk the Shah into getting rid of Mossadegh and ending the nationalization and all that. That was even before the run up to the coup. But the Schwarzkopf, that is General Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., played a further role. In the midst of this, he apparently promised the Shah that if he would stand up tall, okay, the overthrow of Mossadegh, the coup against Mossadegh, that Schwarzkopf would help reorganize the police even further and set up within those a secret police that eventually became, and he did this, the Shah accepted. And so it was Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. who really created the organization that became the infamous SAVAK that killed and tortured so many people during the regime of the Shah. I think that is just a startling kind of connection in that regard, that this father of the commander of Desert Storm was playing a role in the Middle East. I mean, they play it generation after generation, much like the Bushes, you might say.
That is a very interesting connection. Now, the major connection people make is between what happens in 1953 and then what happens in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. Now, I made reference without mentioning his name to Jimmy Carter's remark
yes.
at that time that the coup in 1953 was, quote, ancient history,
yeah.
that it's not relevant to understanding what's going on. Now, I can see sort of a case for that in that Mossadegh was secular. I mean, there was no Islamic aspect to any of that. So the idea that would have been connected to an Iranian revolution later seems a bit thin, unless the Iranian revolution was not merely Islamic, but also nationalistic. And, you know, that I'm sure the Ayatollah Khomeini would not actually have been a fan of Mossadegh, but he would have been even less of a fan of British intelligence and the CIA interfering in his country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think you're exactly right. And Iran has and had 100 years ago a very complex society. I mean, when historians talk about the run-up to all this, they, you know, bazaar merchants, that is to say the merchants in the big markets in the cities as a class are a highly respected, highly cohesive class of people in Iran. And so it's a different, you know, in other words, they have a different setting and they have a different kind of market approach in Iran, but that it makes the sort of demographics a little bit different categories. Then there's the whole group, as you mentioned, of the mullahs, these Islamic clerics, and their opinion is important. Before the 1905 revolution, by the way, it was the mullahs who pushed it and in league with the bazaar merchants and then some aristocrats who were liberal aristocrats attempting to do away with the depredations of these awful Qajar kings. So the thing about this is that the mullahs, the clerics, supported an open constitutional system and even an open secular system in 1905. And then here's what happens, just briefly, to point up the, you know, anybody's view of any Iranian's view of what's happening. Immediately after the revolution, when it looked like Iran would take on a new and revived vigor, the British and the Russians in 1907 just simply invaded and divided that country and called it a condominium so that each of them could take resources out of the country and ruled it for several years just as an occupied country. Okay, so that's how the British responded to that constitutional revolution. The British set up a new Shah, who it turns out didn't play along after World War II started. So in 1941, the British and the Russians and the Americans invade the country. deposed that Shah, put his son, this person we've been talking about, Mohammad Reza Shah, in the power, and so forth. Then comes this coup. And so how much do foreign powers have to intervene before people just say, well, the heck with that? The British talk about democracy. The Americans talk about democracy. But look at this. So I think that has a huge impact on many people, not just the mullahs, but certainly them in Iran, when it comes to the Iranian Revolution of 79-80. You know, an interesting thing is that in the first governments of the Ayatollah, remember, the Ayatollah was Khomeini was appointing governments, and one of the first prime ministers was Bakhtiari, who was a member of the local Mossadegh club. I mean, he was a part of that whole movement. So at first there were those elements. Of course, one thing that radicalized all of these relationships in 79-80 was the hostage crisis. And that was basically a kind of radicalization of the revolution on the side of the Ayatollah and his various parts of the, you might say, Islam on steroids, or Shia Islam on steroids, that kind of supported him.
Yeah, actually, can I jump in for a second? I think we have enough young listeners who won't even remember the hostage crisis. So can you just tell people what you're talking about?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because in the midst of the Iranian Revolution, some elements of a sort of militia called the Iranian Guard, in other words, part of the revolutionary forces, took over the U.S. embassy and held the people that they captured in there as hostages for many months. And it was during the presidency of Jimmy Carter, and the Carter administration just seemed very ineffectual at getting it back. There was a mission that was a disaster in the desert. At that time, Ross Perot sent in some mercenaries who were able to get out, not any of the embassy people, but some other Americans captured along at the same time. It was a thing that radicalized, again, it radicalized both sides. And in America, people turned against the Iranians as these demonic people, and it was a very, very ugly period. Eventually, the hostage crisis ended when Ronald Reagan became president, and he took credit for it, though a lot of the negotiations had happened before. But it was a sad, and all the hostages came home just to fill people in. But it was an awful kind of fight, and as tensions and mounted on both sides, this is really, you know, it's part of the enduring image of American-Iranian relations. You know, Tom, let me say this here. This is I like to say this when I'm talking about Iran and Persia. You know, this country, this of all countries on earth, has in large measure provided the functions of civility and courtesy and social kinds of lubricants in the ancient world and in the modern world. It's a funny kind of thing that this people influenced the old Arabic caliphate, and these rude, crude Arabs adopted Persian manners, and then later Crusaders go to the Middle East and they adopt the manners of their enemies and so forth. They really have played this role, and it is an excessively polite society. When you learn a little of the Persian language in the first chapters, they start talking about all the ways to say thank you and how to negotiate arriving at an elevator door at the same time with somebody. It's a society that even now is concerned with politeness. And so it's a kind of travesty that that this horrible episode of especially the hostage crisis created these tensions. Now, this is not to say that the Iranian Revolution wasn't a violent and bloody revolution, especially as carried out by the the most fanatical of the revolutionaries, the secular revolutionaries, thought that they could ride the wave, and they could not. And in the end, so many people were executed or killed or jailed or tortured. So it's in the end, it was, you know, we're not talking about good guys and bad guys here. It's because, as usual, in talking about history, there are not that many good ones.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, so as we wrap up then, we want to assess the significance of this, why this matters, why it's important for Americans to understand it. There is a kind of short-sightedness on the part of Americans that maybe exists in other countries, but it doesn't matter as much because they don't have empires across the expanse of the world. So it doesn't really matter
right. How
much knowledge they have.
Right.
But for Americans to think history started yesterday, then they're not going to evaluate the news properly because they're going to think people just have grievances that have no grounding in anything. And so that, I think, to me, that's the main reason that we need to understand this episode. How do you feel about this?
I think that's very true. And I think that if ever there was, I think this is quite useful in analyzing the American empire, in that you see exactly as you say, that there's a long history behind these things, that other people have opinions, that that Iran has its own internal history. And then come these empires to dismantle and disrupt and so forth. And the United States, I regret to say, is part of that. You know, Tom, I didn't mention this, but that Constitutional Revolution of 1905, 1906, it had two American heroes. There was an American missionary, Howard Baskerville, who decided to fight for that revolution, and he died in the first days of the revolution, manning the barricades and attempting to get an Iranian constitution in place. The second one was a young businessman from New York who was appointed by the Persian government to work out their finances, a man named Morgan Schuster, who wrote a book about it. And he was disappointed because, as you can tell from the title of his book, it was called The Strangling of Persia, and he meant by the British and the Russians. So anyway, there was a time when Americans were really in favor of helping Iran and helping with education and helping them, you know, get their money straight and so forth. But to go to this sad point of today where we have a Bolton, where we have a Pompeo saying all these things about Iran and other places too. But I think this is a really good illustration, a particularly clear one, I would say.
I want to urge people, even though it's not directly related to our conversation, if you haven't already, you should at least in the course of your life read one book on World War I. You just need to. It's a catastrophic and yet fascinating event. And there's no better source to consult than Hunt Tooley's book, The Great War, Western Front and Home Front. So I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/1450, our show notes page for today. Well, Hunt, you have done heroic work. You've been here twice in as many weeks. And I will let you now go rest and enjoy the remainder of your summer. But thanks so much.
Tom, thanks so much. I've enjoyed being on the show both times, and I appreciate it very much. I enjoy doing it. Thanks.
All right, folks, if you do not go claim my free ebook, AOC is Wrong, about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, goes through all her major issues and just smashes them all, then I'm going to hunt you down and find you. Okay, it's easy to get this book. Doesn't cost you a thing. AOCiswrong.com is a very, very satisfying thing to type into your browser. Come on now, it's going to give you pleasure. AOCiswrong.com. Can you believe old Woods here was sharp enough to have purchased that domain name? I mean, that, come on. People would kill for that thing. Well, the old man here has it. And you are going to get yourself a really great information-packed ebook that'll help you defeat everyone. So, got another episode for this week coming out tomorrow. And then next week, folks, it is Scott Horton week on the Tom Woods Show. I am starting off that week with an episode where we go through maybe half a dozen war on terror hotspots and get an update. What's going on today? Not the whole history of the situation, but what's going on right now? I mean, I bet if you asked a lot of people, like, what's going on in Libya today, most of them wouldn't know what to say. So we're going to get an update. And then in the ensuing episodes, we're going to get into the weeds on a lot of these issues. And in fact, I'm going to be asking folks in my supporting listeners group what they think I ought to cover on Scott Horton Week. If you enjoy the Tom Woods Show and you're not in the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is my private group, then there's some kind of weird mismatch going on here. You definitely want to do that. You get a lot of great gifts, not just transcripts of my interviews, but I give away signed books and discounts on things and lots of nice goodies, but also membership in my private group. So you definitely want to be in there. It's over at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.